Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Geeks Codex. I'm back this week. My name is Matthew Briggs. You know me, you love me, sort of, and some of you have also done terrible fan art of me. I am joined once again by editor extraordinaire Paul Stevens.
Hello there.
And the effervescent James Kirk.
The ever effervescent.
Ever
Yes, that's why I said it. I was hoping that I would get this result. I have won.
Well done. We are back this week to talk about all the things that we normally talk about. It's getting weird. It's getting geeky. It's getting codexy.
No.
Is that even a word?
No.
Okay.
No.
So James, kick us off. You got some info, news for us.
Yes. So the one TV show that I am excited for this year finally has a full-length trailer, by which I mean, oh my god, Good Omens has a trailer. I've been waiting my whole life for this.
I am an angel.
You are a demon.
We're hereditary enemies. Get thee behind me, foul fiend. After you.
So, like...
Love how we're excited over trailers.
Oh, and the thing is, I'm not somebody who normally gets excited over trailers. There's a couple of specific things that I get excited over trailers for.
Yeah, it's usually my job.
Yeah, it literally is. I often avoid watching trailers, like, deliberately. But for Good Omens, it's been one of those things, like, because Good Omens is my favourite book of all time. I don't think it's the best book of all time, but it's my favourite book of all time. It's the book that I have probably reread more than any other book that I own. Also, I own, like, 4 separate copies of it for various reasons. I have given away copies. Like, I really, really love Good Omens. And I have spent the last, like, 10 fucking years of my life being like, we will never actually get a Good Omens adaptation. They've tried so many times. And I always say, the thing about the Good Omens adaptation is, it doesn't even matter to me if it's good. I don't give a shit. If it's the worst adaptation in the world, I don't care. I'm just very excited to be watching a thing that is Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett's Good Omens on my screen in front of me with real flesh and blood people involved. But also the trailer looks good. It exceeded my expectations. I really liked it. David Tennant looks really great in the role. Michael Sheen has really won me around. I was really confused when they announced that they had cast him. It was not what I was expecting at all, but I've really come around to him through the trailers. The actual, like, editing and cinematography looks good. They clearly have some money because Queen is in the new trailer, which costs a fucking bomb to license. So clearly maybe they just spent the whole budget on Queen. I don't know.
Isn't it Amazon that it's coming?
Yes, it's the only reason that I have ever had to watch a show on Amazon Prime. So it's a good thing my mother has it.
They got their Jeff Bezos money.
Yeah, okay, 3 things now. First thing, did you hear the Radio 4 radio play?
Yes, I did, the day it came out. Yeah. And I had mixed feelings about it.
Yeah,
I have not.
Okay.
It's good, but it's only good if you've already read the book. I don't understand what it would be like if you have not read the book to listen to it.
Yeah. I hadn't at that point read the book when I listened to it. And as you say, it's an interesting ride, but it's...
That's the one with Sarah Frenowitz in it, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I need to listen to that.
It's good, but you have to have read the book, I think.
Yeah, because there are lots of bits where it's sort of like, here's a lot of information that you're just going to have to assume happened, because
it just assumes that you know what happens and thinks, okay, we can skip this bit, which I think for a radio play based on Good Omens is actually a fair assumption. I don't think a lot of people will have listened to a radio play of Good Omens without having read it, but it's just kind of like, one of the things I'm looking forward to with Good Omens is that they have confirmed that they are going to be, like, utilizing the narration, because that's why they cast somebody as the voice of God, because they were like, well, somebody has to read the narration, because that's a lot of the good writing in the novel, especially the bits where, as somebody who's read a lot of both their work, like, I can tell when it's Terry Pratchett writing a bit. Like, I have specific bits in the book where I can just point at it and be like, that's a Terry Pratchett line. And as a huge Terry Pratchett fan, a lot of that isn't in the dialogue. It is, like, Terry Pratchett's mark is very much in the narration. So one of the things that I'm looking forward to is the fact that they're retaining that. Another thing I'm just looking forward to is the fact that nobody in this show can dress themselves. And I think that's very in character. The costuming, a lot of people got really annoyed about the costuming, but I'm sat here like, no, they can't fucking dress themselves. That's perfect. So that's like the one television show that I'm actively excited for in 2019.
Second thing, have you heard the thing about Neil Gaiman about why he's produced the show?
In terms of it being something Terry Pratchett requested. We heard Neil Gaiman talk about that. We went to see him for his Christmas.
Of course you did, because I listened to that episode
on
the radio, whereas you listened to it in person.
Yeah, so...
We were there. So also, it was longer in person.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, great.
So, for those...
You missed content.
For anybody at home who... I don't think we've mentioned it on the show. Neil Gaiman did the BBC Radio... what's it called? The Christmas series they do where they get, like, an artist or a writer to just kind of come on and talk about art that they like.
With great pleasure at Christmas, I think it is.
So yeah. Briggy, bless his soul, managed to win us tickets to the live recording. And we went.
For telling me about the tickets.
We had a great time. The ukulele orchestra played Wuthering Heights. Peter Capaldi was there reading poetry.
Twice. They played it twice in person.
Peter Capaldi read poetry that was based on fucking folk song. It was great. I loved it.
We got whole sections that they just straight up messed up and had to do again. I'm like, oh, I got to do this the second time around. Let's do it.
And he told the story there about how, like, before Terry Pratchett died, and I nearly cried when he said this, before Terry Pratchett died, he had said, you know, before the lights go out, I believe is the phrasing, I want you to actually finally fucking make Good Omens, because they've been trying since the 90s. And then he
It was a good joke, actually.
Yeah, and then Neil Gaiman...
It was the last thing he asked me, which means now it's a death request.
Yeah, he was like, and then he went and fucking died on me, so then I had to do it, because it was a, like, last request. But yeah, so for me, it's something where it's like Good Omens is one of my like forever books. And like I said, it's not even like I'm not going to be upset if it's bad. I'll just be like, at least it exists.
I mean, I like it. I've not read it. I've listened to it. But I've not listened to the radio play. I've just listened to the audiobook because it was longer. So that's the one I put my Audible credit on, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's not the Pratchett adaptation I've been hoping for, so... I'm excited for this. This is going to be good, but I'm still waiting on that whole City Watch TV series to happen.
Apparently that's
CSI Ankh-Morpork.
That's gone back into pre-production.
Yay!
Fingers crossed, Rihanna Pratchett really wants to fucking get this done.
Third thing was, it seems at the moment with American Gods and Preacher, and this obviously, someone at Amazon has gone... Let's give the people who can write well for geeks money to make
literally
shows. And it seems
tangent
like...
from that, but you are right in the news that broke this week was they've got a writer for the live action Gundam series movie. Have you heard about who the writer is?
No, who is it?
It's Brian K. Vaughan.
Oh
yeah,
and after Saga,
good choice.
Yeah, if anything, that guy knows how to make you care about a character before racking up a death toll. So, perfect for Gundam. But that's a thing that seems to be happening more often now with this, with all the things you just mentioned with the Gundam movies. Take these well-established writers, you know, usually comic book writers, but not always, and give them the things that we want to watch.
What I will say is, I think somebody in the industry noticed, oh yeah, comics writers are script writers. Maybe we should get them writing scripts as opposed to giving it to like novelists or something. Like I think somebody clearly went into Hollywood and just went, guys, I've just realized when people write comics, they write scripts. So if we hire comic book writers to do these things, they know how to write a fucking script. I do think it benefits.
It's not new. It's just more prevalent now.
It's a lot. I think what's happened is gotten a lot more mainstream.
Gary Witter's been doing it for years.
Yeah, but like that's one person. And I think it's a situation where we're seeing a gradual, like amassing.
And I guess well or not depends on how you like Book of Eli, I suppose.
Mm.
Yeah. But Rogue One was good.
The script was the weakest part of Rogue One, to be fair.
No, you leave Witter alone.
It was good. I'm just saying that the cinematography was and the editing made up for a lot in that film.
But also, it must be that if you are a comic book writer, you must think visually about your medium, which is really important on things like shows on a television.
Unless you're Rob Liefeld.
And also, you can often think episodically. So for television, works really well. What I'm saying is somebody give James Robert a television series, please. Oh my God, give James Robert a television series.
All I was going to joke about is that clearly Rob Liefeld doesn't visualise feet in his mind.
He's got an anti-foot fetish.
I was going to say, you can't as a writer.
He's credited as writing some things. Credited.
Stan Lee is frowning at us from heaven.
I'm not saying whether or not he did or didn't, but he's credited.
I mean, they were bad, so he probably did.
Yeah. I'm not talking about Deadpool.
No.
The things that came later.
Yeah.
I mean, also, his run of Deadpool was the worst run of Deadpool.
Oh, yeah.
So, except for maybe some of 90s Deadpool. He was credited on some of the... Anyway, we've gone off topic.
Sorry, I could never miss an opportunity to just, you know, diss Liefeld.
This is literally
I hope he follows me on Twitter on one day.
Briggy, this is how we met. I agree.
Yeah.
But we met because I dissed Liefeld.
I agreed.
But the other television-related thing, I'm just all about the British TV, is that being as current as I always am, I finally watched the final Stephen Moffat series of Doctor Who.
Which just happened and will not date this show whatsoever.
This is the gateway to everything that ever was, or ever can be.
It's like a...
spaceship.
Kitchen.
What?
That is a robot. It speaks emoji.
Mars.
1814.
Get it!
Nice here, isn't it?
So how do we stay out of trouble?
This is naughty.
Exterminate.
Something's coming, Bill. And I have the feeling that we're going to be very busy.
And the reason being, I don't watch Doctor Who as it comes out anymore. I tend to watch the whole series in one go. So I'm now kind of like, shit, I need to watch like the new Chimbor and Jodie Whittaker series, because that's like on DVD and shit now, I think. So I was like, oh, I need to finally watch it. And I enjoyed it. And I'm a huge critic of Stephen Moffat's work. I have very complicated feelings because there's a lot of his Doctor Who stuff that I love, but it's in spite of the fact that Stephen Moffat was there writing it. But I think it was probably his most solid Doctor Who series. I binged it all in like one night on Netflix, and there were some bad episodes, but Bill was a great character, and it mostly just reminded me that when Doctor Who is good, I really want Doctor Who. So after I finished it, I was like, should I rewatch some of Stephen Moffat's stuff? And then I was like, nah, I'm going to go listen to the Big Finish audio dramas. And I just started listening to those again, because those are the best Doctor Who. I don't know if either of you two have ever listened to them.
They're really
on Spotify now, you know.
I was just thinking about how Doctor Who is very much like this podcast. It's all over the place and no one knows what year it is.
Literally.
Paul, insert some rim shot.
Give me the warp, warp sound. Start playing Doctor in the TARDIS, which I know all the lyrics to. But
I'm more of a fan of Inspector Spacetime, if I'm honest.
I mean, I do like Inspector Spacetime. But
No, we're going to stop that there, because that show was like good and then got bad, whereas Doctor Who has good... like,
was good series. And then got bad and then got good again. Yeah. Just waiting for that movie community.
Listen, as somebody who has watched a lot of classic Who, it is up and down all the fucking way. It is a roller coaster. But
yeah.
But one thing that it's made me do, probably in a couple of weeks, you will hear me talking about some of the Big Finish Doctor Who audio plays that I've been re-listening to. Because I basically remembered some of my favourite sci-fi ever is some of the Doctor Who radio plays, like Jubilee by Robert Sherman, which is the one you've watched, Christopher Eccleston, Doctor Who, haven't you? You have?
Oh yeah, I went from Eccleston until it got bad again.
Yeah.
So, yeah. End of Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah, then it got bad again.
I'd say middle of Smith is where it got bad, but there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
But the episode Dalek...
Is this an instance of where it's kind of like the old TV stuff where some of the radio stuff just doesn't exist anymore, despite the fact people know it's out there?
No, the radio stuff all exists. It's
it?
The first 50 audio dramas are now free on Spotify, which is great. Jubilee was written by Rob Sherman, who wrote the episode Dalek for Eccleston, which is the Dalek episode everyone of our generation remembers, and it's adapted from Jubilee, but Jubilee is 100 times better. It's really like dark spoof.
Did
parody.
You just assume our generation?
We're literally the same. Shut the fuck up. But I know how fucking old you are. You're 45.
Yeah, which is why I remember Day of the Daleks.
But fucking don't even talk to me about it. But that's the thing that you lucky folks at home can look forward to. Me talking about obscure radio dramas by a writer you've probably never heard of that I love very dearly. That's our future.
Never tell us that we're not niche.
There you go. In terms of the last series of Doctor Who that you'd watched, mm-hmm. I watched the one previous to that and then just didn't get around to watching that one. because the previous series did a thing where it's like, here's a bunch of massive lore that's just going to be finished now. In terms of the new stuff that it treads on,
yeah,
what would you say was your favourite part of it?
Of series 10 or series 9? Series 10. So my favourite part of 10 is that it is a soft reboot.
Ah.
Basically,
wait. Series... Which one's 10?
It's the final Capaldi series with Bill, the black companion who wears the prince shirt.
Okay, so it's new 10. Okay, just...
Yeah, sorry, no, it's new series 10. Not So in Doctor Who fandom, season means old Who, series means new Who.
Oh, that...
I'm not even kidding. We're just terrible.
We don't have time on this show for me to explain the number of things wrong with
I know, but that's just what we do. So it's...
A series is a whole series. Doctor Who is a series. A season is an individual season.
I know.
Only the BBC uses series for season because they're wrong.
I know, but...
And we pay them for the pleasure of them being wrong.
Anyway, so one of the interesting things is, so season 10 takes place quite a long time after season 9 from the Doctor's perspective. The gap is kind of bridged by the Christmas special in between, but you don't have to watch it. So it kind of sets him up. He's been on his own for a while, and he's now, like, not traveling around. He's a professor at, like, Cambridge. Just a weird professor who's been there for, like, 100 years, and everybody just politely ignores that he doesn't die. And the new companion
just is... Just like real professors.
Like, he meets her through lectures, and they there's, like, enough emotional distance from the previous. And because it's Stephen Moffat's last series, he doesn't have as much time to do that thing he does that I hate, where he sets things up, like, 3 series in advance and then never pays them off. Mm. Because he never actually had an end plan. He just knows how to make you think something better is coming. Briggy knows what I'm talking about. He's watched the H. Bummer Guy video that I'm talking, referencing.
He's right.
He is very right. If anybody wants to know why Stephen Moffat is, like, a bad writer of serialized television, H. Bummer Guy did a video on Sherlock I recommend.
I'd go so far as to use the word hack.
Yes, but... The thing is, because he had one series on a soft reboot and he knew he wasn't coming back, he kind of reins himself in enough that it's much more enjoyable. And Bill is a really great character. She's fun, and Pearl Mackie is amazing as her. And she, every time the Doctor gets really melodramatic because Moffat doesn't know how to stop himself, she just comes in and just cuts straight through it and is very funny and very charming. I wasn't that fond of the finale to the final episode, but beyond that, I mean, it's just like normal fucking Doctor Who. It's not Stephen Moffat 3 series in fucking bullshit. It's just normal Doctor Who. And it's charming, and it has some really emotional moments, and the three-parter in the middle, there's a three-parter in the middle that is really good and interesting and does stuff that Doctor Who has never done, like, philosophically. Like... There's some stuff in there that reminded me of some of the best of Doctor Who. So, I mean, I have complicated feelings on Moffat as a whole, but I will say, if you stopped watching before Series 10 because you didn't like Moffat, consider giving just Series 10 a go. You don't have to watch any of the preceding stuff for it to make sense. It's a good lead-in, I think, to what Jodie Whittaker then does. Because while Chimbal isn't following on from Moffat at all... Whittaker is 13 from the couple of episodes that I did watch just when they came out before I didn't have a TV license. Like, she's very much following on in terms of, like, being a reaction to Capaldi. So I'm also just really looking forward to watching more of Whittaker.
Because in terms of the series that I did watch with Capaldi, one of the things that's really strange is I'd watched the Eccleston series, but I hadn't watched...
Tennant or Smith.
Yeah. And it was a case of there is a lot of expectation sometimes with Doctor Who that you probably should know more about certain things than other things.
Which I think one thing I will say is Moffat has a huge weakness for this, because Moffat is almost as much of a Doctor Who nerd as I am. And I'm nearly as much of one as Capaldi is. And Capaldi started watching in the 60s. One of the other things that I would say is just... Stephen Moffat got to a point where he wasn't writing Doctor Who for children, and I think Doctor Who should at its core be written for children. I think that it is at its best, not exclusively for children, it's family viewing and the family watches it together. I grew up watching it with my parents, but a lot of the later stuff that Moffat was doing, kids obviously are a lot more online and in fandom now than they were when we were like 10, but they're still not... There was stuff that I was struggling to get, and, like, I know a lot about Doctor Who. Like, I made a joke before we started properly recording that I've forgotten more about Doctor Who than most people will ever remember. Mm. Like, I really have. And it's just not accessible. And when a show like Doctor Who isn't accessible, then I think you've done something really wrong.
Yeah. It's that thing where if you don't know in terms of what your actual, the core, not to use the word, but the core tenets of what a show is.
Tenets.
Yeah, I know. I'm
laughing.
Want to say it.
But no, I know what you mean.
Yeah, if you don't know like the backstory or the in-depth sort of the mythos of the show, especially one that has so much baggage. I mean,
oh, and especially one that predates home video. So Doctor Who continuity is in part a mess because it's extremely long running, and most of its run was before anybody thought you'd ever rewatch it, which led to this thing where it's like Doctor Who canon isn't real. And like Russell T. Davies kind of understood this. People used to complain that he was retconning stuff, but he basically understood that he could take whatever he wanted in whichever series and then take something different the next series. And he was just like, you know what? The people who are watching this don't give a shit. Like, the kids that are watching this, as long as the story's good, they don't mind. Moffat, and I can't say if I was in his position, I wouldn't make the exact same error, which is why nobody should ever give me a TV series to write, just gets really obsessed with lore, which, as somebody who memorized a lot of pointless, stupid Doctor Who lore, that's for the fandom. It shouldn't be in the show. Mm. I love that stuff, but I can do it on my own time. Don't write it into the show. The show isn't designed to like appeal to me as like a fucking ridiculous 25-year-old obsessive nerd. Like, it needs to be appealing to a much broader audience than that.
In terms of the whole, it was the last series of you're only allowed so many doctors and all that sort of BS.
Oh, I fucking, that's such a, I wish they'd never done that.
Yeah, and it did seem like...
Do you know what that continuity comes from?
Nope.
One line in a serial nobody likes.
Good.
In like the 80s, if I recall correctly, that is a line, I swear to God, and it's been a while since I watched it. I think it's from Trials of a Time Lord, which is Sixth Doctor. Somebody's going to fucking at me and tell me I'm wrong, but I haven't rewatched any of Six's run in a while, and that's what's coming to mind. Nobody fucking, if it is, and if I'm correct, nobody fucking likes that serial. And it, again, predates the invention of home video.
Because it's that weird thing where you're like, people have this expectation that, like, oh, this is like a big monumental thing. And then for the casual viewer, like,
what the fuck?
Yeah, I don't understand why this is a thing that we're supposed to care about, but cool.
And also, as a fan, I didn't fucking care about it because it was a stupid offhand line from a bad serial. So,
yeah. But and the other thing that was a bit weird towards the end of the last series that we watched was when they had Maisie Williams come in.
Yeah, Shilda.
Yeah, and it was sort of like, and here's an alternative show that's taking place that you'll never see.
Oh, the ending of so you probably didn't watch Clara's last series. Did you see her exit?
Oh, when she spoilers. Fuck it.
It's been years.
Yeah, some people still get angry. Yeah, when she gets killed and then brought back and
I have really complicated feelings because my favorite Doctor Who companion and one of my favorite characters ever is Clara in the 12th Doctor's series. I really love her, partly because she's in a lot of ways very unlikable in a way that I think is very interesting. I really love her. She's an unusual character for Doctor Who, but the ending was very like, all it did was make me want that show way more than Doctor Who. Yeah. I wanted morally ambiguous, technically dead Clara running around with literally twice the age of the universe, a shielder, in a time machine that looks like a cafe, being like vaguely homoerotic together.
See, doesn't that sound like a great show?
I think I'm feeling right now what other people feel when I talk about things that I'm super into that I've got no idea what's going on.
Briggy doesn't like Doctor Who very much.
No. I think the reason I've been quiet for a lot of this is because a lot of the complaints you have are literally the complete opposite of the complaints I have about Doctor Who. Doctor Who, I like the wacky and weird lore. I like how deep it gets on itself. My problem with it is it's Britain's only forefront science fiction show that we're putting out there to the world, and it's still kind of garbage. Like, it's still stuck in a time... like
they've and relative dimension in space.
It feels like a 60s show still. And like we talked on the last episode about the Orville and how they do what they're doing on still not a huge budget, but compared to other major sci-fi, it's a small budget and it works for them. I'm also doubly salty on this front because, you know, I'm paying for Doctor Who to happen and it's not working for me. But it still feels a super low budget when it shouldn't be. It's got such a mass acclaim to it, a huge worldwide following, and we don't have... I think the last thing I enjoyed in a way to get across what I like about it and what I thought was good about it and where I think it should be going forward was The Day of the Doctor. I went to go see that in the cinemas.
I did too.
That had money attached to it. It had lore attached to it that went deep. It had great actors in it. It had John Hurt in it.
I wish we'd have more John Hurt.
Cool, interesting things. That was the last time I really enjoyed watching Doctor Who, and I don't think I've enjoyed it since. Not that Capaldi's a bad actor, but I don't think I've enjoyed his run on it at any point. And I never really got into Whittaker's either.
One thing I will say, I can't comment on the Whittaker thing. I enjoyed...
Apart from that first episode of Whittaker that takes place in Sheffield, and that's just got, yeah, Sheffield well, represent.
I was going to say, I've only watched the first couple of episodes. First episode.
For once,
great.
We're not in Wales. But, how nice is that?
Well, we weren't... With Moffat, we were in Scotland a lot. But with regards to the way it looks, I think there's a really interesting element of... So there's two things. I know a lot about the behind the scenes. I know a lot about the behind the scenes stuff of Doctor Who from the original reboot run. So Russell T. Davis's run. I was following it very actively. I've known people who were tangentially involved in that production. So basically, what happened was they didn't think it was going to succeed, so they gave him a shoestring budget, and then it went really well. So what the BBC said was, that means you can do it well on a budget. We don't have to give you more money. And while they've loosened up on that somewhat going into the Moffat era, the BBC's opinion is very much, it's extremely successful without the budget, so we will give you money, but we're going to limit it as much as we can. The other thing is, and this is one creative decision, I don't know if it was Moffat's decision or somebody else's, during the Moffat run, they struck on the idea, if we can spend a lot of money on excellent direction and post-production, like colour grading and things, that will be visible during every scene, or we can spend a lot of money on special effects that only show up in the flashy scenes, we'd rather do the former. Moffat-era Doctor Who has some very bad special effects, but it has some very good direction and cinematography. Rachel Talalay is basically famous in the fandom. She does a lot of Stephen Moffat's finales and big episodes, basically for having stupendous direction in episodes that have very little money to spend on other effects. And I think that basically that's, as somebody who is a bit of a film nerd, I notice that there is unusually good cinematography, colour grading and that kind of post-production direction in the show compared to a lot of other British shows. It feels very prestige. You get to a sci-fi special effects bit and it's kind of shit, but a lot of Doctor Who is actually character drama and you see a lot more of that.
Yeah, okay, I agree on a lot of those points. The problem you've got, though, is regardless of how good the cinematography is, the set design for anything set in the future that's meant to look sci-fi is trash. And I mean, I'm sorry if whoever's responsible for those set designs is listening and feels personally, you know, called out on that, but it's trash, it's garbage.
I will say that...
But that's the thing with the BBC. The BBC always do anything to do with period drama really well. So all your past episodes...
Do you know why?
...always look fantastic, but that's all they're good at. They're a one-trick pony, but and we can never get any good sci-fi out of it.
There's a specific reason for that, and that is that the BBC recycles all of that stuff, but... Doctor Who is the only sci-fi show they do. So the reason that the future stuff looks worse than the past stuff is the past stuff comes from, like, the Pride and Prejudice wardrobes that have been there for 20 years.
Future
stuff, they have to build it, and they don't have very much money. They basically have less money, from what I understand from the behind the scenes, than people think they do. Because they basically like, well, we've got a couple of good cameras, we've got a couple of good directors who will work with us, and for the past episodes, we can steal Pride and Prejudice's wardrobe. We can trick everyone into thinking we have money. Even with regards to things like certain monsters look a lot better than others, it's the recurring monsters, because they put the money into those and then they bring them back like 10 times. Mm. They're still using a lot of the same shit that they were using back in 2005.
Yeah, that's my problem with it. I'm having to like tiptoe around the subject, so I feel like...
No, I think
if I start outing myself... my opinions on Doctor Who. Our listeners may or may not like me anymore.
I think it's absolutely
because
fair.
I have two very strong opinions. Like, there's only two ways I think you'll ever get me to watch Doctor Who again, and I think to save the entire franchise is either A, throw all the goddamn money you've got at it to make it the best it can possibly be, or two, let it die quietly so that we can eventually reboot it again to be better.
But the thing about that is just, as long as it's not even like a production thing, it is a BBC thing. As long as it's successful when they're not throwing money at it, they have no motivation to throw money
then
at it.
And let it die so that someone else can buy it.
But they're selling it around...
Like Disney!
But no. Briggy is looking at Paul. One thing that I will just say about that, they have no motivation to let it die because it's one of very few things that does good in foreign markets. The BBC has like three exports: Sherlock Holmes, Doctor Who, and period drama.
Yeah, they used to have Top Gear, but we won't talk about that.
It's so much better on Amazon. Yay, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, but the point being is I would argue that at the moment, Doctor Who, as a low-budget thing, has what is the British aesthetic.
It does.
It's like Red Dwarf. It looks trashy because...
Or Babylon 5.
But Red Dwarf does it on purpose.
Babylon 5 doesn't.
For comedic effect, and it's brilliant. That's why we love Red Dwarf.
But Babylon 5...
Because it's quintessentially British.
Babylon 5 is brilliant, and it looks like garbage.
Confession, I've never actually watched Babylon 5.
How have you never watched Babylon 5?
I haven't watched much of it, and I haven't watched it in a long time.
It's been on the list for decades. I just never get to it.
I will say I've never finished Babylon 5.
It does.
Bring it. I've never finished Babylon 5. I've watched some of it. What I watched was extremely good. Also, it looks like garbage.
On the face of it, it does remind me of the Wing Commander movie.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's basically
which is why I've never gotten around to it.
Yeah.
Because it didn't have Mark Hamill in it. That's the only reason I watched that movie.
It's uniquely British dark sci-fi that is also campy. Like, it's dark and campy at the same time.
Did we make Lex as well? Is that British?
I think
because that's also garbage with a lot of its special effects and stuff.
But that's the point, is that in terms, as I say, even if we didn't, the aesthetic being you can get away with doing a quite low-budget sci-fi because if you're doing, like, a dystopian future... Mm-hmm. Everything looking like a warehouse.
A quarry. It's a quarry.
Or somewhere where it is literally just, here's a bunch of pipes, is grand because we can do a bunch of pipes on a relatively cheap budget. If you want to be able to have an entire planetscape that has a proper biome and everything else and make it look good, you have to have that Hollywood money, which people don't want to spend if you could just go, oh, look at that planet, and then just not show them, just show the reaction.
And the other thing I want to say is, Briggy, you love tokusatsu shows. They have much worse special effects than Doctor Who.
I mean, I was going to bring up the tokusatsu stuff eventually because I know we're going to talk more about that later on in the show. But yeah, there's no... When you look at something like the tokusatsu genre from Japan and how long that's been... I mean, you can see there's comparisons there in that it's been running longer than, if not as long as Doctor Who from its original
Doctor
inception
Who is 63.
I don't actually know when when Jetman at Night wasn't Jetman.
It was 69, wasn't it?
Toku predates Sentai.
No, I'm...
Japanese Spider-Man was a Toku show before there was
a Sentai
show.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Tokusatsu, Godzilla is technically a Tokusatsu movie.
Yeah, why, it's the instigator of a lot of the modern...
So it's got its trappings in being just as long-running as something like Doctor Who. The difference is its target demographic and also the expectations that come out of Toku shows... is that it's meant to be kind of shit.
But so is Doctor Who.
It plays directly into being kind of shit. And it has no other shows around the world that don't steal from it directly that are trying to, like, do something else with it and push it above and show how good it can be. Whereas Doctor Who, despite it being campy, British, ridiculous, tokusatsu sort of stuff, is part of the science fiction genre.
I mean...
And the Americans came along and went, look how good it can be on a shooting budget. And Star Trek was around the same time. The original Star Trek was not too far off of when Doctor Who was a thing, and that was a significantly better show.
The thing is, Doctor Who has always been and will always be a show aimed at fairly young children. And so to a certain extent, its target audience isn't comparing it to...
Its target audience isn't young children anymore.
It literally is.
That might be who they're targeting, but that's not who their fandom is.
Briggy, which one of us watches Doctor Who?
Watched it. Just because I don't like it so much anymore.
Briggy,
I've not been a part of it.
Again, I know a lot about the behind-the-scenes stuff of Doctor Who in terms of how much money it makes off of, like, children's merchandising and stuff. Its primary audience from the BBC's perspective... and from the new writer's perspective, and from Russell T. Davies' perspective, was always young children. Moffat was an exception, not the rule. Its primary audience is young children.
It has a magazine that sits alongside...
It has a kids' magazine.
Everything else, like Barbie in the magazine.
And it is very popular.
So does Spider-Man.
that's still for kids.
Yeah, but that's not saying like, that's where their primary money, like their
income literally
comes from.
Is.
Yeah.
Young children aren't the ones going out buying ridiculous amounts of merchandise.
No, they're the ones who are telling their parents to.
Oh, yeah, but they're not doing it in the same quantity of cash that adults are. This was Young Justice's problem. People said that Young Justice wasn't going to be popular and couldn't continue because the toy sales weren't doing very well, but they were targeting the wrong people. It's back now because they've realised that they screwed up on that.
Doctor Who
will have that same thing, I should hope, eventually.
Doctor Who makes most of its money off of merchandising, and most of its merchandising is not collected by adult audiences. It makes enormous. I mean, in the toy industry, Doctor Who is a legend. It makes enormous amounts of money, and very little of it is bought by other audiences.
It's the Pixar car scenario, in that
yes,
sometimes stuff for kids is actually for kids, and it makes more money than anything else.
Seriously, Doctor Who does not have a huge number of expensive collectibles. It does not have much of a collectible market in terms of that stuff. But, and again, I know a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff. I follow it. They don't make money on the DVDs, and they obviously don't make money on the show because
nothing
it's BBC.
Makes money on DVDs now.
Well, yeah, but also like they don't make money on the show because there's no advertising because it's BBC. They make fucking
maybe that's
gangbusters.
Maybe that's a personal prejudice of mine, is that I can't sit and believe that kids are watching Doctor Who and buying the merchandise because there are tens of thousands of better things for kids to watch and buy merchandise on. The only people still funding Doctor Who are the diehard Whovians that refuse to let it die.
Briggy, it's factually untrue. I mean, you don't follow the Doctor Who fandom.
You don't even have to follow the Doctor Who fandom. Briggy, who do you think buys most of your tokusatsu stuff?
Oh, Japanese kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But well, not even Japanese kids. Kids. Well, Power Rangers still being a thing today is because kids buy plastic things. And they can charge an insane markup on what is essentially
so much.
Something that costs them pennies to literally like 30, 40, 50 quid for what is a picture of David Tennant's model or whatever it is, Doctor Who thing.
I cannot express
those
the Doctor Who.
Those markets are totally different, by the way, just on terms of the tokusatsu and sentai stuff. The molds are shared, but it's two different
groups
of people. So the money being made by Power Rangers currently is significantly higher than the money being made by Super Sentai.
Yeah.
And the money being made by Doctor Who is still considerably more than
it
you'd
is.
Like to believe.
Seriously, when I didn't realise how much, because I was kind of thinking, I don't understand why they're still going for this kid show that is, even with them not having a huge budget, it's more of an investment than most shit on beats like CBBC, for example. So I was kind of like, I'm kind of surprised that the BBC is still going for it. Then I looked into like the behind the scenes stuff with regards to the merchandising. Oh my God, they make a lot of money. They could get rid of the fucking license fee on that shit.
Which kids is this aired at?
Ages 8 to 12 is the official.
Doctor Who airs at 7 p.m.
It didn't used to. It used to wear at 6.
But even so, the point is now is you are literally marketing to dad sitting with child and going, oh, I remember this when I was younger. Let's sit down and watch this together.
That was my childhood.
It's a bit spooky. Oh, but it's okay because you're mature enough. Oh, and yeah, we can get you that toy at the weekend.
Yes. And it's not even just toys. The books.
Oh, God, yeah.
They released like 8 hardback normally priced, like not kids priced, normally priced books a year. These books sell a lot, and I can attest to that because A, if you go into any library, they have fucking all of them, and B, every kid I knew at school up until when I was like 16 bought every single one. At one point, if you go from the Ninth Doctor, we will move on from this, I promise, but if you go from the Ninth Doctor to the 11th Doctor, I actually own every single one from when I was like a kid and a teenager. And I was not the only one at my school. And the people who owned them weren't nerds, to be very clear.
Mm.
They were not nerds. They were buying tie-in books for Doctor Who at full hardback price, and they weren't nerds.
But that was then.
This was only like 6 years ago. It's still very popular.
No, I mean in terms of target demo.
Oh, the kids, there's still kids buying them. Like kids fucking loved 11. Seriously, Briggy, all I can say to you is I'm fairly deep in the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. Doctor Who's target audience is children. It has remained children. And the merchandising is aimed at and bought by children.
If you want one thing to prove it, look at the Christmas specials. Because the Christmas specials...
Adults don't like those, but they sell merchandise because the kids fucking love them.
Yeah, because it's that thing where you go, here's an advert on the non-advert BBC... for the next year of the products that you will want to own because this is your talking
point. And they always have a toy that is like basically designed for the Boxing Day sales. Like, the monster, it almost always ends up being something that is toyetic. And the reason is because they can, quote unquote, put it on sale during Boxing Day and buy it for kids.
Okay. Just side note, I love the word toyetic. Have you seen the episode of Freakazoid where it's used?
Yes.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It's literally...
Have you watched The Toys That Made Us on Netflix?
No.
I still haven't.
Highly recommend 2 seasons of that. They
need to watch Transformers.
But they explain where the term came from.
I don't know where it came from, but there was an episode of Freakazoid where literally they break into the episode so the marketing executives can sit there and explain what toyetic was.
Minor plug there for anyone else that hasn't seen it on Netflix. The Toys That Made Us. Fantastic show. Especially including things like He-Man, Star Wars, Star Trek toys.
They have Transformers episodes, don't they?
Transformers,
I need to watch that.
But
they have a Sanrio episode for Hello Kitty as well.
Oh, I want to watch that.
Oh, okay. 2 things. First of all, movie coming. Did you see the link I put out? Hello Kitty's getting a live action.
Yes, I'm very... After seeing... Oh my God, I just realised there's something I didn't talk about in when we were talking about what we should talk about. I've completely erased from my mind that we saw the Sonic the Hedgehog live action design.
Yeah, that's special. Okay.
That is
so
special.
Doctor Who is a very complicated show, but do you say you watch it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, cool. Sonic... What the actual fuck?
I'm going to hyperventilate. So you all remember, anybody who has stuck with us for some reason since I started this show will remember that I had a mental fucking breakdown that Paul literally had to edit down about the Sonic the Hedgehog teaser trailer. And you all fucking thought that I was overreacting. Have you seen this, Briggy?
Yeah, I don't think it's that bad.
His eyes, you know what he looks like? You know those games that are like freemium on the App Store that are rip-offs of some kind of game? His eyes look like that.
Go faster, Spiky Man.
What were you expecting other than his eyes looking like that? Because they couldn't possibly have done in a live-action movie that's going to have actual actors alongside Sonic the Hedgehog before they saw any footage of the Detective Pikachu movie for Sonic to have the mono eye.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
My question is, in terms of live-action blue characters, who is more disturbing right now, Sonic the Hedgehog or Will Smith as the genie?
They're definitely the same Will Smith. Thing. It's a bit weird. But here's the other thing I want to know about Sonic. So... why are his stomach and muzzle both furry and flesh-coloured? This is a very important question, and if Yuji Naka does not come to my house and explain it, I will be forced to take drastic action.
I know, Sega don't like the design.
I know.
No.
But
they've already said.
Also,
but I kind of dig it.
He's not wearing gloves, but he has flesh-coloured fur on his hands.
Oh, and he has Nikes.
Yeah,
Nikes.
Product placement.
Yeah.
I'm getting a pair of those Nikes.
I gotta
go fast.
Also, his proportions are... I saw somebody tweet that they didn't usually get the Uncanny Valley effect, but they finally understood it after seeing it. Because it's too super deformed to be realistic, but it's too muscular and hyper-realistic fur to be super deformed. It's just... And then his eyes are cartoony, but his body is muscular and furry, and I don't know what to do with this.
I'm not going to freaking out, but I'm excited to get my day one ticket for Sonic the Hedgehog.
Oh, I'm seeing the midnight premiere, to be very clear. Briggy, we're fucking doing this.
I don't know why you guys thought we were getting a Sonic the Hedgehog movie, because clearly it's a Sonic movie, and I'm all about it. Me and Billy are going to see this movie. It's going
to
be awesome.
To be clear, no, you and me are seeing this movie on a midnight fucking release. I don't care if we have to break into the theatre.
I'm going
to
say that I'm watching this film.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm really good for not watching
it. Dude, it's got Jim Carrey in it.
I do not care.
Briggy.
And what's this guy?
I'm going to use my skill at
Ben Schwartz. The guy that played John Ralphio in Parks and Rec writes a lot of that stuff. Like, just because Sonic looks weird, and he was going to look weird regardless, come on, it was going to happen. It's still going to be, I think, a good movie overall. I think it's
going to
be okay.
I think it's going to be
funny as fuck.
I sincerely think that it's going to be an avant-garde fucking masterpiece. Briggy, we are going to do that thing. You know how I'm really good at sneaking alcohol into theatres?
I'm not going to need any.
I will.
You'll be high on Sonic.
Smoke those quills.
I just hope this movie's about 5 seconds long. So we can have the gotta go fast joke. Yeah.
Please. I don't want to look at it.
It's a full length movie. It's an hour and a half, 2 hour movie.
But it's just 5 seconds long.
But they just speed it up. So So the whole thing's in like a supersonic speed.
I've waited my whole life.
It'd be great if the opening to that movie is the entire movie played in like hyper speed, and they're like, wait, hold up, we went too fast, and we have to roll it back.
You know what? That's a better creative idea than we'll be in the entire film, because that film is going to suck.
No, I got complete belief that they'll do a good job with it, if only because the writers involved in it and the actors involved in it are actually kind of great. I don't think it's going to be the Sonic movie that people wanted, but I think it's going to be the Sonic movie they realised that they didn't know they wanted. No. It's going to be funny, it's going to have Sonic jokes in it, it's going to...
No, I think it's going to be horrific.
I feel like it's going to be a pastiche of itself while you're watching it.
I think it will, but not in that way where it's like, this is a clever and funny take on this. It'll be like, I see what you've done. You've literally dug up the corpse of something and you put it on string and you're dancing it around like some sort of horrific carnival.
Yeah, but that's kind of where the Sonic the Hedgehog franchise already is.
Yeah.
Like, this is exactly the movie I was expecting, which is why I'm not disappointed or shocked in the slightest. This is the Sonic franchise now. And has been for years.
Well, no, they made...
Everything after Sonic Colors just reeks of this.
The thing is, I understand how we got to this point. I'm going to literally write an essay.
Mania's fan-made.
I was going to say, you love Mania, though.
But yeah, because Mania's fan-made. If we get a fan-made movie... It will be the best actual Sonic movie, but the genuine movie is the Sonic Forces. It's going to be tacky, weird, no one's going to be able to agree on whether or not they like it, but overall it's going to be a perfect exemplar of what the franchise has become.
I am literally in the middle of writing a video essay about how Sonic got to this point. You liked my tweet about it,
yeah.
Paul, but I do think that the Sonic movie is like both the ultimate... culmination of the Sonic franchise as it has been since the Saturn era, I would say, with the weird spin-offs, and also basically just a perfect explanation of late-stage capitalism. It's just focus testing to the point of becoming unrecognizable, and I'm just sat here, I can't wait, it's going to be awful, and I can't fucking wait.
Who do I have to badger on Twitter to get a Sonic and the Black Knight movie made?
Me. Listen, if I ever make any fucking money, I will make it myself.
Okay.
Or a Secret Rings TV series.
Both of them. Listen, make me famous.
Shit, Wii games. Shit, Wii games.
Hey, Black Knight was almost, sometimes, occasionally entertaining.
Playable, though.
I was going to say, Unleashed is worse.
But, I mean, that's... You dug a hole to get the bar that low.
Yeah.
Unleashed came after, though.
Yeah, but it's still a Wii game.
That was cross-platform. The other two were Wii exclusive.
On Wii, it has a very bad frame rate.
Yeah, because it's not a very good game. But more importantly, Sonic has lots of current faults.
Going back to 95. Yeah.
But at the same time, that doesn't justify what is a crime against eyes.
I for one welcome our new robot, rodent overlords.
Have you been paid off by these jobs?
I mean, how do you think we're keeping the website running? It's all that Sega money.
Listen, if we're talking about our robot overlords, like, at some point I am going to make you all read the new Transformers comics.
I want to see the Metal Sonic
based
on this Sonic.
That would be terrifying and eldritch, and I love it.
Yes.
Do you think it's going to have abs?
Yes.
Oh my
yes.
God. It's going to have a 12-pack.
Oh,
and Sonic. It will be voiced by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And someone online will give it a 2-foot dick.
It will be Arnie himself.
Oh, good. So yeah, that's the thing.
I'm sorry, I derailed our podcast. No, nobody planned fine. For this, but nobody planned for Sega to make this fucking movie.
Well, someone did. Like, a really just weird person.
I mean, I'm going to watch it.
Oh, seeing it opening night. We're going to find somewhere that has a midnight premiere.
You know what? I can imagine the people who are going to see it. Again, split audience, where you have like 50% of the people there who are like, oh God, Sonic, this is going to be amazing. And the rest of the 50 people are like, you're in for a shock.
I will be the person who bridges both sides. I will be there thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a disaster. But I will be in a fursuit.
This is why I've not been responding to the midnight opening thing. Because I know that I'm a giant fucking nerd, but even I draw a line at the fursuit.
Shut the fuck up.
I think you mean miles per hour.
I am commissioning a fursuit. We're fucking reliving my 11-year-old ill-advised childhood on DeviantArt. Let's fucking do this.
No.
Please leave the fursuit thing in, Paul. Please.
Yeah, that's fine. If you'd like Briggy to go to the launch of the
then
Sonic,
donate to my coffee.
The Sonic movie in a fursuit, if you just tweet him relentlessly.
If we can reach a listener, a regular listener count of at least 250 unique listeners by the time this movie comes out, I'll wear a fucking fursuit.
I will buy it.
I will shill myself.
I have furry friends. I will fucking commission one for you.
I mean, I'm not paying for it, but...
I will.
But if we get listeners to come listen to the show, yeah, I'll haul myself out.
Cool. I'm going to tell the Discord that I promote this on that if 200 of them listen to it, then you will do this and they will demand
250.
Pictures.
250.
Yeah, I'm sure that we can manage to get the other 50 somewhere else.
DeviantArt.
Oh my god, I still have a DeviantArt account. I can just revive it. I'm sure they all still follow me. I joined DeviantArt when I was 11. Don't let 11-year-olds do this.
Yeah. Yeah. This is all staying in now. Before bits of it were cutting. This is not now.
I look forward to listening to the final cut of the podcast to find out how fucked I really am.
Yeah, you know your whole section at the end? That's gone.
No, tokusatsu for Briggy, just fursuits.
Hey, if it gets us 250 regular listeners, I ain't giving them.
Well, hey. We made it to 5 episodes. Good shot, guys. Well done.
But hey, speaking of tokusatsu.
Oh, we segue into that now.
I did the thing.
Oh, now you can play the intro opening to Tokusatsu Gaga Gaga, because I love that
song. And pretend that I am dancing to it.
There we go.
Okay, so this last 2 weeks, as you two are well aware, because mm-hmm. I've done nothing but fucking talk about it, and this is why I've been quiet most episodes, I've been saving my voice to talk at length about Tokusatsu Gaga Gaga.
You weren't that quiet. Quieter.
Phil, was I quieter this week?
The is important.
That was very quiet. So yeah, I've been watching Tokusatsu Gaga Gaga, which just recently has finished its run in Japan, and it's a new J-drama that is based on a manga, and you've read some of the manga. I've read the first chapter of the manga. I didn't get a chance to read much more of that. It was something that I meant to do when I heard it announced. I was like, oh, I'll read that, then watch it, and completely forgot about it. Then this week, when I realised I'd done too much real-life things and not enough things for the podcast, I was like, oh, I'll start watching that. I think, I'm not even going to bury the lead on this, but I think that this is my show of 2019. I absolutely adore this show, despite not having watched the final episode yet, because I ran out of time pre-podcast to finish catching up on it. But it is absolutely wonderful.
One of the things that I'm really interested to hear your take on, because, I mean, we've joked before about how our backgrounds inside of, like, media, and especially in, like, Japanese media, are very different. So watching, because you showed me the first episode just before we watched it.
Yeah, we might want to cover just the basics of anyone.
In terms of the concept, yeah.
For anyone that's not heard of this or seen me tweet out about this, which I'm sure there'll be plenty of tweets between me recording this episode and everyone actually listening to this mm-hmm. episode, Tokusatsu Gaga Gaga is a... The drama, I don't even know what genre it falls under.
Slice of life.
It's a slice of life slash sort of tokusatsu.
This is what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, it uses the tropes of tokusatsu and the tropes of slice of life to become something significantly greater than the sum of its parts. The story follows, I'm going to forget all the character names now because I knew them last night.
Nakamura, isn't it?
Nakamura's main character. She's one of the few people I can actually remember the name of. It follows Nakamura Kano, who is an office lady at a mid-sized office, who grew up watching tokusatsu shows as a big fan, and then continues to watch them even though she's no longer the target demographic. And
she's an otaku.
So she's a tokusatsu otaku, or a tokuota. This is really interesting as a story coming out of Japan, because over in Japan the whole culture is not quite as open as it is in the West in terms of being a giant geek and having shelves of toys like
especially
I've got right behind Paul.
Especially at work.
Especially, yeah, in your workplace, which is something that I can't relate massively to, because on a daily basis at work, like, same. I'll run into Paul and we'll talk about just nerd shit.
But we are also in the privileged position of working in industries where
this is the thing.
Yeah, we're in IT.
For context, so. These two work in IT. I work in the customer services department of telecoms staff. So while I'm like the only major nerd on my team, everybody's used to the guys in tech being nerds. And yeah. So, like, for context, I have a lot of Batman figures on my desk, like. A lot. Briggy bought like half of them for me for Christmas. I have them set up on my desk now.
Hey, that's awesome. But yeah, I get stuff at me at work from some people, specifically upper management, that still take the mick out of my desk toys, as they call them. I've got
the Enterprise.
I've got a built model of the Enterprise E. I've got a bunch of pop Funkos from Batman. I've got some Q pops from Batman. I've got the still got the plushy ones that you bought me from the post office of Batman and Harley, which I thought were quite cool. So there's stuff around my desk, and I'm not the only one in the company that does that. So as we are in IT, and especially me specifically being in the web development portion of things, it's not surprising to find other nerds and people that are passionate about nerdy type topics. So it's really interesting to see, watch this show and see the storylines that they portray with Nakamura hiding away the things that she's really into because she may not be understood, I suppose, or ostracized for having these sort of interests. But watching it, one of the things that it brought to me was a reminder of school. Like, this is the sort of thing I definitely dealt with in my younger years when I was in school, start of high school, like, the ostracization and like being a geek and a nerd and being the outcast. And it's like, I get that on like a base level, like inside. I understand that. And that kind of sells the show a lot more to me, doubly so because I'm actually myself a Tokuota.
Yeah, you really are.
I love Tokusatsu. So like the jokes in there, some of them are really quite fun, like not deep cut, but definitely without a knowledge of the history of Tokusatsu shows. Without some of their explanations would probably fall flat, and even their explanations to me are kind of funny in places, but mostly just serve the purpose of explaining what's going on. But without them, I think I'd still enjoy it just as much, just because like, oh yeah, I get these jokes because it's, you know, I'm still watching Tokusatsu shows. But the acting is fantastic.
Oh, it's so funny.
Before we go on to like the actors and the way that this show is done, like you had some...
So there's two things that I found really interesting, because for context, I watched the first episode just before we recorded this podcast. I really loved it. So I very much grew up watching a lot of Japanese media that falls into the shoujo genre, including a lot of slice of life stuff, and that moved me into a lot of J-dramas. So one thing I think is really interesting is you don't have a history with that kind of media the same way that I do. So watching that, it very much felt like a lot of stuff that I had seen previously that is very much like, in Japanese media terms, is shoujo. Even if it's not literally shoujo anime, it feels like that's a style of J-drama that exists that I have seen before that is very much aimed towards a female audience. And I think it's really interesting to see the crossover effects of doing it with the toku element in terms of how you feel about it. Again, it's not in terms of the actual content, it's just the actual demographic it's literally advertised at.
Maybe don't take my reactions to it completely in a vacuum, because I'm not, like, a stranger to the slice of life genre.
This is the thing, though. Yeah. What I've seen is that while you don't have a lot of experience with shoujo anime,
I've not watched the Magical Girl stuff, but I'm a big fan of things like K-On!
Yeah,
so I've seen plenty of Slice of Life, and...
But not all Slice of Life is shoujo. Not all Slice of Life is shoujo. Lucky Star isn't shoujo.
No, but I mean, that's Slice of Life, so, yeah.
Oh, but this is very specifically... It falls into the same... One thing I was thinking of a lot was Princess Jellyfish, for example. It falls into a very specific pre-existing set of specifically shoujo otaku stuff.
Okay. Can I just
intersect
for a second? There is that whole genre of, and this doesn't sound horrible, women of a certain age in Japan shows. These are the shows where if you are not married, you worry about not being married.
Christmas cake.
Yeah. And this is your life. And then something else happens along with that. But essentially you work in an office and something else is happening, which is your unique hook. And then the real thing you have to do is feel bad about not being married.
It's a Christmas cake thing. It's a whole genre thing. And a lot of it doesn't get exported to the West because it isn't super relatable. Because the age, the Christmas cake joke is, it's not worth it after the 25th. So in other words, it's the idea that if you're not married by 25, then you're never going to get married. Which isn't relatable to Western audiences because we don't have quite as much of an age-related pressure in like 2019 as they do in a lot of Japan. The Christmas cake joke is that joke.
So perhaps there's a limitation here to you only having seen the first episode. Because that as a theme... is only really present again in around the fourth or fifth episode for a short amount of time. It ends up dropping by the wayside by the end of the first episode to be an entirely separate sort of theme.
What a lot of it is, that genre kind of existed and it kind of really came into its own in the 90s. And then basically a lot of mangaka in particular and like older female mangaka essentially were like, we're going to take the basic concepts that this has established and we're going to subvert them. One of the most famous examples in the West is Princess Jellyfish, which I don't know if you've heard of Princess. So it's a shoujo manga, or, I mean, it kind of straddles the line between, like, shoujo and for an older female audience, which is about a female otaku and a man who is really into, like, Lolita cross-dressing fashion, like, colliding together into this kind of weird, we're unacceptable and on the margins of society kind of cross-section. And I think it's the first major success in the West to kind of show what female older mangaka kind of did with that kind of stereotype, in terms of, we're going to take it away from being about that kind of marriage pressure and into just being like, maybe girls are just interested in nerdy shit. So one of the things that I really found interesting about that first episode, and you are correct that I've only seen the first episode, is it kind of followed that pattern of being this situation where, like, it's a show that is very focused on what I guess from a literary perspective, the academic in me wants to call, quote unquote, female interiority. It is a show that is not just like about a woman, but is very much like, this is a show that assumes you give a shit about the internal monologue of the female nerdy main character.
Yeah.
It is not a show that has a framing device to make it more palatable to people who might think that that's weird. It is a show that just straight up assumes that you give a shit. And like I said, part of it is that it fits into a pre-existing genre that targets real people who fit in some way into that demographic. But a lot of it, I think, is also just this thing where it's like, it grows out of this whole tradition in especially manga and anime of going from portraying that kind of woman as like a joke and as needing to like be given like a husband or something, into like this thing that we see now, where we see more and more shows like this where they have cross-gender appeal and they're very much like, actually, maybe you should just fucking do what you want and maybe you should just fucking enjoy your shit and maybe you don't have to be married by the time you're 21. Which, again, in shoujo and in related genres, like even 10 years ago, was like not a thing. It was just not a thing. So I watched this and was kind of like, oh, it's drawing on that tradition, but doing interesting things with it.
I would say, in terms of your, specifically Briggy's, fandom of
Taku stuff,
you will get, as you say, the deep cut references. You'll mm-hmm. get the things where you're like, it's things that from, when, as I say, I've read the manga and up into the translation of the manga, as things like references to capsule toys and things like that. And the different types of releases. They have a whole thing about Happy Meal toys. And specifically...
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, boy.
That sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, because they tie that in. I don't know if they do it in the manga, but there's a bit in the episode that follow, that is part and parcel of the whole Happy Meals toy thing later on. Because they do the Happy Meal thing twice. Yeah. The second time, also going back to Nakamura's past to talk about the choice between a black or a red backpack for school.
Yes.
So that was traditionally black for boys, red for girls, and later on it changed. So she has that whole thing, and it's done really well. I don't want to spoil it for people. Like, it's hard to talk to any massive degree about why I enjoy this show without spoiling it for other people, because it is really the character moments.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you've seen through the lens of a Toku fan, like me as well, there's bits and pieces in there that you can... It's nice to have, oh, here's this Toku fandom that clearly exists, and that... You know, they're aware of, mm-hmm. even in Japan, to the point where this as a manga and a show can exist. But using that to sort of funnel through, like, just everyday life in a slice of life way. Later on in the show, you end up with up to 5 people as part of this little group they've got going on, which is nice because it mirrors the 5-person.
There were 5-man band. Which one is the Lancer?
So they've got the whole Sentai thing going on. They did the whole joke for the additional hero, which is the
Lancer.
Sentai trope.
The Lancer, yeah. That's what I call it.
Well, it's a... I can't remember. There's a term. I've forgotten it.
On TV tropes, it's the Lancer.
Ah, okay. Not in this, it's not. Yeah, so they do. So they've got a whole group, and it moves through multiple things that they deal with in a very slice of life fashion. One, they've got a whole beach episode, because of course you're going to have a beach episode, which is hilarious. It's really well done. But a lot of the poignancy that comes from that episode is the fact that they're all quite significantly different in age, and so it's all dealing with growing up. So it's nice to have a character that is at a certain point where you throw Nakamura directly in the middle of it. So you've got her looking back at the younger characters, like, still towards the end of school before they're about to start job hunting.
Like Damien.
Damien's
not part of
the group.
I'm
joking. And all the way forward up until, you know, her older friends, the two of which that have got their own, like, sort of problems. And there's definitely more that I don't know about one of the characters, because I'm sure it's in the last episode and I'm interested to find out where that goes with it. But you can see that there's this whole her looking across the spectrum of age for people, even those that are about to begin job hunting that are considered too old for a hobby, up until those that are much older, and you can see them all sort of reflecting on this. And but even though they found each other as a friendship group and have a good time, and they can all share their love of thing, which, I don't know, I like that because it made me think back to being in school and being, you know, instantly, without any need at all, I was drawn to stuff that people went into, the weird niche stuff.
Mood.
And then finding other people that were like, oh yeah, no, I also kind of dig this niche thing, and then forming those sort of friendship groups, which I always knew of as being part of, in school at least, and even through into secondary school, high school, as being, you know, the nerd outcast.
See?
So we formed our own groups. So then outside life, it becomes less like that. But it is interesting to see that through the lens of that sort of society that they have in Japan, that culture, where that persists into later life, because that would be hell for me. I can't imagine having to hide my cabinets of amazing expensive toys every time my mum wants to come and visit me.
Honestly.
Which is exactly what something that happens in that show is a fear that goes through because she's not accepted by her mother for being an otaku. I was like, well, my mum goes on online sometimes and just buys me Zelda merch for the hell of it. And
honestly,
I don't have that side of things.
The important thing to take from this podcast is, if you want to make some fucking money, just come rob Briggy. I'm looking at like a grand
don't
worth
come
of
rob
figures. At least a grand.
Yeah, let's go with that. So
probably a lot more.
Just going to say, this is that thing where the slice of life meeting the... It's essentially the others thing,
yeah,
with the slice of life. So it is the...
It's the hook.
She's a young woman in the prime part of her life who happens to have a really big fandom for the shows. And everything goes around that side of things. But there are also like a dozen shows out there where you have the young woman who's really into superbikes,
mm-hmm,
or she's really into horror movies, or she's really into...
Yeah, because they do that within
the show.
It's a
whole genre.
Their five-person group isn't all Tokuota. It's only the two of them that are into tokusatsu. There's two more that are into following idol groups, which
there
is considered to be something you shouldn't be doing after a certain age. And one of them's into the Precure stand-in they have on the show, which is Love Cute.
What it is.
So there's a guy into Love Cute, so they get to do that sort of shift as well. So you've got these five people all into things that they shouldn't really, as far as society concerned, be into, but all sort of just having fun with it. And at least from the tokusatsu side of things, I mean, I don't know how well it's going to translate to other people that aren't into toku. I mean, I still want to recommend it as a show that's a comedy, but for me, watching it, this show has been hilarious.
What it is.
Really goddamn funny.
There's a whole genre of J-drama, and a lot of this doesn't get exported to the West because it's not easily localized. But there's a whole genre of J-drama that is specifically aimed at 20 to 35-year-old women, which is basically aimed at making you feel less awkward about still having hobbies after leaving high school. And this is a part of, like, one of the reasons it's not very exported is that it's a part of Japanese feminine culture. Women in particular, a lot of the things that it's okay for younger girls to be interested in as children, such as toku shows, it's much more unacceptable for adult women to be into than adult men. Like, not to suggest that there's no stigma against it for adult men, just it's very specifically like a thing you're supposed to grow out of as a girl. So there's this kind of... One of the things I think is really interesting is that there's this overwhelming sense of, like, female friendship in what I saw of the show, which is specifically about connecting not just with other fans, but with other female fans, which I know several people who are from Japan and who are in Japanese fandom is very true to life in terms of fandom experiences there. Because it's not just about, like, the idea that you're getting shit for being a fan, it's the idea that you're getting shit for being specifically an adult woman who is still into that stuff, because it's seen as, like, it's seen as tomboyish. And it's okay to be a tomboy when you're 6, and it maybe is even okay to be a tomboy when you're 13, but it's not okay to be a tomboy when you're 25.
Mm. See, I didn't take anything away from that in that degree. I found it to be a minor part of the show. I find that it works completely gender neutral.
It does.
The same thing across both genders. And they play that up in a later episode with one of the characters being the guy being into the Love Cute stuff. They point that stuff out, like, it doesn't matter.
Oh, well, that's a different kind of nerddom. They're considered very different kinds of nerddom from a Japanese perspective.
But it's not, though, and it's played the same. They play exactly the same from the toku to the Love Cute stuff in terms of the fandom and
them
not, they shouldn't be into it.
A man being into Love Cute and a girl being into toku are the same. A girl being into toku and a man being into toku wouldn't have been the same.
Well, they still point out as in Japan as being an otaku thing.
Yes, but all I can say is from my discussions with friends of mine who were like into kind of like fandom and nerd culture in Japan, there's a distinction that is made that isn't necessarily easily translatable, but it kind of reminds me a lot in terms of people who are fine with me being into shoujo, but think that it's weird that maybe, like, I like dude video games, for example, which is something that I have run into with non-nerds in my life, where it's kind of like they're more willing to accept that I really like Sailor Moon. And all of this comes from pre-transition stuff. So in the context of them viewing me as female, like, they were way more comfortable with me being nerdy about Sailor Moon than me being nerdy about, like, shooting video games, for example. And a lot of it was very explicitly like, well, of course you like Sailor Moon, you're a girl, but, you know, it's weird that you play video games, because those are for boys. And so that's even present, like, still. And this is, like, after I was 18. This is not, like, 10 years ago.
That's one of the things that, from specifically the manga, that comes through quite clearly, is the judgments aren't from the peers, they're from the external forces.
Yeah.
So the mum character,
yeah,
is essentially, she's a model for the rest of society.
Yeah.
Is the understanding is,
she's the Mikado kind of figure.
Yeah, she is literally, everyone else thinks this about you because this character thinks this about you, and it's not nice. It's not, the fact that she has feels that she has to hide it isn't because of what other people think it as, like, an abstract. It's because of what her mum thinks about it. And that's the difficulty in the manga. One of the things that, whilst I found the show, like, I've only watched the one episode, and whilst I found the show fine, I have a real thing with J-drama in that tonal shifts,
mm-hmm.
are like a fucking ricochet, where you'll be like, it's just like
back and forth,
and you'll be like, oh, this is a really heartfelt thing, this is a really funny thing, this is a really dark thing, this is a really funny thing, and there is no
J-drama
let up.
That's just J-drama.
I like that. It's the same reason that I really fell in love with GTO.
Yeah,
as a J-drama, I absolutely, GTO is one of my all-time favorite shows, and I think it's now been surpassed as a J-drama, at least in terms of, you know, me liking J-dramas. Yeah, it's now Tokusatsu Ga Ga Ga, but they stand, I think, very close in terms of the kind of J-drama that I'm into, which is that whole, you know, self-discovery through adversity sort of thing that they do, but they do it in a very slapstick, almost, manner about it. So those tonal shifts into the slapstick. My favourite parts of the show, outside of the more heartfelt moments, like in episode 2 when they go see their first live-action Toko show, those moments are absolutely fantastic. I love those, like, little character moments where it's they bring it down and just focus on the subtle emotions that you can see, because, like, it does get better after episode 1 in terms of, like, the setups for, like, you know, the acting and the expression and getting these things across slightly more subtly, in my opinion.
Mm.
But the best parts really are just the huge toss-ups, like the Toku stuff and the jokes that they throw in with them in the slapstick moments. You get to have both of those flowing into one another. There's great moments with the kid, Damien, in episode 3 that I just think was, it took me back and to being a kid. And there's moments in that show, I'm like, oh man, yeah, that was an emotional gut punch there. But it's done through the lens of something very tokusatsu, and I was like, oh, I know this feeling because I had Power Rangers as a kid and I did the same goddamn thing, and that made me go like, yeah, I like this throwback all the way to someone that is the target demographic of that thing. I'm like, that's why I remember loving this stuff, that's why I like toku now. But you get that full range of people. I think it's, maybe it's just the different upbringings that we all had that gave us this different lens for what we took away from the show. But
we all have very, the thing about this show, sorry to interrupt you, Paul, but the thing about this show is it takes inspiration from multiple genres.
Mm.
And I think we all have experience with, like, one of the genres it takes from.
Yeah.
So for me, it's very much like an extension, an evolution, and in some ways a subversion of certain types of J-drama that are aimed at, like, 20 to 30-year-old professional women. And so for me, it's very much like it's playing on certain tropes that I recognize in that genre that are really interesting in the way that it does it, in a way that tries to bring it back to be gender neutral and appeal to a wider audience and say, hey, maybe everybody can relate to this female protagonist going through this stuff, while also being like, hey, maybe a certain amount of this is bound up in gender stereotypes.
Mm.
You, Briggy, obviously come to it from the toku side of things. And so you're
not just toku, though. My opinion of it is that now that I've seen this story and I've been through it, you can take the toku out and replace it with X anything that is geekdom. You can take it video games, you can take it with anime, you can anything that falls under the geek bridge.
Yeah. You're coming at it from the generically geeky side of things.
Yeah, it's geek acceptance.
Yeah, yeah. You're coming at it from the side of things that has more to do with being a part of fandom and a part of being geekdom, and in the way that that impacts things. And I mean, Paul, it sounds as though you're coming at it more from the J-drama side in general. Yeah. And so you're coming at it more from the mainstream, because a lot of the stuff that I watched wasn't super popular. It didn't get second series. It wasn't like a phenomena. Whereas you're coming at it more... So we're all kind of coming at it from a situation where we're culturally literate in what we're talking about, but it's a different kind of... And I think that's one of the interesting things about the show, that it crosses over a bunch of different elements that me and you, Briggy, can have very different perspectives on. It is interesting because we're coming at it from situations where we recognise what it's doing, but what it's doing is very different. Now, I interrupted Paul, so we have to let Paul speak.
I agree with that in terms of, like, you are very... It's one of those shows that you will be very coloured on what you have got in terms of your personal history. And one of the ironies is one of the things we were going to talk about on this week's episode, but we didn't, is a show called High Score Girl, which is an anime. Three things. It's trash. Don't bother watching it. But it takes place in arcade games during the 90s. And it's one of those things where I enjoyed the show because I knew arcade games in the 90s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, this, again, is one of those things where the rest of that show was a slice of life romance where the main protagonist was a dick and girls, for no good reason, were falling in love with him. Because,
a shitty harem anime.
Yeah, it was one of those. But it had things like references to Final Fight. And so I forgave it.
Okay.
I feel that.
Yeah. And it's similarly, I'm not so bound up in the toku side of things.
That's fair. And I think it gets a lot of its comedy from the toku side of stuff that I appreciate. And that's one of the reasons I started watching it. But I think after watching the whole thing, I'm very set on the idea of, you could take out the toku and put anything else in there, and it is a story about that geek acceptance, which we didn't have a lot of until things started to become more mainstream. And it was one of the things that I praised, was the fact that the whole geek culture thing was becoming more mainstream, because I found it so hard to be in that outcast society as a geek growing up when I was so much younger. Like, I remember back to, like, you know, early, like, junior school days through into, like, secondary school. Like, that was always a real bad time. And the fact that it became more mainstream, acceptable to be into stuff, and someone says, oh, yeah, Spider-Man, like, goes, oh, yeah, of course I know Spider-Man, it's millions of dollars and people know it. That's not a thing in Japan now, which is where the story is. But then, because it's a great, absolutely fantastic story of just acceptance, you can see the analogies in there, not just for geekdom and specifically toku, but you can go even further out of that, and it sits as a parable for, like, any kind of acceptance.
Yes. And one thing that I will also...
awesome.
One thing that I will also say is, I very specifically related to that episode that I watched in terms of, I didn't just get bullied at school for being a geek, like, I did, but it was very specifically amplified by the idea that people had no frame of reference at that point, and to a certain extent now, for, like, what they saw as, like, the female geek. Like, it was like, it's bad enough that you're a geek, but if you do that while not being a boy, then basically what you're doing is you're failing at two things. Mm. You're failing to, like, fit into mainstream society, and you're also failing to be, like, feminine enough. So it was kind of this double thing where, on the one hand, like, even the other geeks didn't like me because they were like, well, we don't know what a female geek looks like. And then in terms of, like, people who weren't necessarily thinking that far ahead, they still didn't like me because I fucking read on my fucking lunch break and, like, I knew a lot of nerdy shit. And so one thing that I think is really interesting is, like, she's very concerned specifically with judgment from, like, her fellow office ladies, like, from her female peers. And, like, they're talking about, like, when they think of otakus, there's a bit in the first episode where they talk about how they found out, like, such and such's boyfriend is a secret otaku. What they're kind of really talking about is, like, this thing where it's like, we think people who are like this are shitty, sad dudes who you shouldn't date.
Yeah, it's an intolerance.
And, yeah, but what they're also kind of saying is, I mean, that's very specifically, like, a weird, creepy dude thing. And when we complain about annoying dudes, then we're complaining about that. So if you have, like, a female character who is that thing, then there's a specific extra level of, wow, that's not just, like, weird. That's, like, we don't even know what that is. And so it's like, it appeals to everybody and like it says something to everybody who's been in that situation. But as somebody who kind of went through that in school, it's very specifically realistic to the experience of being like, with a lot of like, and especially like in the 2000s, like with a lot of people who were bullied for being nerds who would like read as dudes and who were being dudes, it was like they were insulting you, but they knew what they were insulting you for. People didn't even really know what to do with me because they didn't have a framework for what me and my friends and like my predominantly female nerdy friends were doing.
See, going back to that scene though, is that you saw it and interpreted it that way, whereas my feelings on that scene when Nakamura reacts in with her internal monologue to that scene is seeing herself as the same. Not that it was any different to that.
It's not different. And I want to be very clear. I don't think it's that it's there's a fundamental difference. I just think it's a situation where it's always going to be something that it has an extra... When you're dealing with two things, it's always going to be an extra layer of shit. And I think that in that scene, she's basically thinking, you know, it's really shit that me and him would get judged like that. And it's really obnoxious and cruel. But also, like, what would it even look like if she shoved her hand up and said, like, well, I like that stuff? They wouldn't know what to do with it because they think of it as a thing that weird boyfriends that you shouldn't date do.
Not sure. Well, mostly because the show is quite happy to...
Oh, absolutely.
Go along with the idea that...
And I don't think
that Nakamura is not the only one and that it's not a separate issue.
That's the thing that I like, though, that... Rather than use it as a situation to create, like, these divisions, the show is interested in being like, well, what these characters have in common matters a lot more.
Especially because the problems of the show tend to focus on those five characters, and four of those five characters are women, and there's nothing weird about it. So, but they're into different things, but they're all otaku for something.
This is the thing, though. The thing that's really cool about the show is that they're like, well, maybe if people are, like, interested in stories about nerdy women... Those nerdy women are like friends with each other, and it's like maybe their colleagues at work don't understand, but they're all friends. But then at the same time, it's this situation where it's like, maybe the real thing is that it's not actually weird for women to be nerdy, because it's not weird for anybody to be nerdy, because maybe it's just all made up and it's all just stupid gender stereotypes. So I want to be clear, it's not a situation where like being a female nerd and being a male nerd are ultimately different. It's just a situation where it's interesting to consider the idea that people react as though it's different, but as somebody who's in the middle of it, you know it's not. Like, maybe your colleagues assume that all otaku are like male creeps, but you, as the female otaku kind of keeping your head down, know very well that that's not true, and that really you just want to make friends with anybody who likes the same shit that you do. And so it's kind of this situation where it's very much an external thing. It's not an internal thing. It's not a true thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a situation where it's like, maybe I'll be judged extra, but I know that people who like the same shit that I do, if they're not assholes, will not do that.
Well, I think we covered the mental part of that.
Textual.
Textual, yeah.
What's really nice,
I did the literary analysis for you. I have a degree, you know.
I was just going to sit here and talk about all the things I like about the show, because I love the show
so much. Go on. I'm sorry. I talk too much.
I think we're going a bit short on time, but my
You can
word,
just cut my shit. You just talk.
I know. It's all valuable stuff. It's all interesting input from someone else. But from me watching it, like, yeah, I got those warm fuzzies from watching a very wholesome show, and I love all the characters.
Oh, it's the most wholesome.
It's really well acted, in my opinion. They do that really interesting thing where the main character has the inner monologues. It's not just the bits that we saw in the first episode where she's having the delusions of the characters, like Shishi Leo and Emma Jason, which Emma Jason, one of my favourite characters. He doesn't exist, but he's brilliant.
He's thick.
He's thick.
It shows up in the show. It's canon. It's so he's good. Thick.
But yeah, we get to have these moments that reminded me very much of one of our favorite online videos, being the Wrestling Isn't Wrestling by Max Landis, which is that whole she's talking over herself. So you've got that sort of disembodied narrator happening for these inner monologues, but the acting is on point and so well timed that I think it adds just that much extra to the comedic effect. Because that's one of the reasons I like that online video for Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, is Chloe Dykstra as Triple H reacting in all the right ways at the right times to Max Landis' narration of it, so much as including Max Landis' voice of the narration over the top of her not actually speaking but mouthing the words. We get moments like that in this show, and it had me rolling. So much of it has had me in absolute stitches because it is, I think it's purely just a fantastic comedy. Even when you take the Toko
so
out of
funny.
It. I mean, the Toko is a nice lens to put the comedy through for someone that's a Toko fan, but as far as the actual comedy goes, some of it's really well done. And I think one of the things I pointed out before we sat and watched it, because you watched the end, Paul watched the end of episode one where there's just four recording, there's a fantastic, almost Family Guy style cutaway as part of a joke for Emma Jason, because he's a superhero with a secret identity, and she's using that as an analogy for her own situation she's currently in, which is what a lot of the show is about. But talking about Emma Jason having that secret identity, oh, you wouldn't be able to live your life if people found out about your real identity. And it cuts to some kids ringing his doorbell and running away, and he gets to overact his movements as he's like, damn kids, and then goes back and is like, I like
in
these
Falama.
Little bits. Yeah, in full Toko costume as well.
That is the thing I like most about the show, when it's not taking it like the slice of, when it's not slice of life, when it is the ludicrous side of things, when it is literally just, here is a situation, oh, and let's just turn it up to 11 because here's a guy in a full outfit of spandex having your inner monologue for you.
Yeah.
And in the first episode, because there's a bit where there's two old people on a train and they,
oh God, yes.
they walk past, and then even though she's tired because she stayed up late watching her TV show, she suddenly gets a pang of conscience because she's watched a show where he's talked about how even if you're like weak and you're exhausted,
weakness is an excuse.
And to be very clear, she imagined seeing the guy in full costume in the fucking train car.
Yes,
I love that.
And so then she gets up, has a pang of conscience, and then the old people come, and that whole section is great for me up until the point she reacts.
Oh, the giggling.
Yeah, because I've read the manga and a lot of stuff that is played for, it's like, played for essentially the calm down or the laugh off of those sections in the manga is played full on genuinely
just
like
straight. Like
straight.
She just had an intense moment
with
this hallucination.
Where the enthusiasm.
Which, listen, I can't pretend I've never done that.
Yeah. But that's the thing is in terms of sometimes the genuine heart of those sort of intentions, sometimes because of the fast pace of the show, I find it difficult to marry again.
I get what you're saying, but I think that's just a necessity you have to deal with in the adaptation of this kind of show.
Yeah.
Because they do have those moments going through the seven episodes that are available where they do let it breathe and they become genuine moments and they don't play them for laughs at the end.
And those are good.
But there are moments where they will play it for laughs, and that's because they're condensing the material.
The other thing I will say is, and this isn't necessarily to sort of say you shouldn't criticise it or to say you should criticise it, it's fairly characteristic just of J-dramas.
Mm.
Because J-dramas tend to, like, full-on 45-minute J-dramas that don't have a huge budget behind them just tend to have a sort of shorter, like, in terms of the number of episodes that they're given, just because of budget limitations in the Japanese TV
this
industry.
Is not even something, like, specific to J-dramas.
Oh,
this is
British dramas!
Not just Brit. No, this is a limitation I've come to accept when taking anything from page to film media.
But it's there's a
this
difference.
This always happens.
In America, they have 21-episode series. In places like Japan, Australia, England...
I'm thinking even shorter than that. We're talking,
seven.
Like, how long was American Gods? And you have to... There's concessions made for
that's
adaptations.
British, though. It's a British development.
Yeah, but I mean, it's an Amazon Prime shorter. Even something like that that's big budget. Even Game of Thrones.
What I'm saying, though, is that it's a situation where a lot of the time we consider the American prestige drama of 22, 21 episodes, whatever, plus per series, like normal. But for a lot of the world, including England, it's actually normal to have what we might call mini-series, where it's like you have less episodes.
I'm not calling it a mini-series thing. I'm calling it any level of adaptation from page to film medium. You have to make these concessions because that's just what happens. The difference is whether or not they can play it off well. And I think that in the short of it, when you look at the entirety of Tokusatsu Gogaga as a TV series based on a manga, the adaptation that they do from page to screen, while not all of it hits, most of it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after that first episode, once you've gotten through the introduction of the characters, the introduction of the setup and the plot,
and lots of history about Christianity,
it lets itself really like breathe and take itself as a proper adaptation. So you get less of this, the disjointed bits of episode one going forward. I mean, they do still happen because it's inevitable. It's an adaptation, but I think it's overall, And again, I've not read a lot of the actual source, but I was really satisfied with the end product. So I think this is one of the better adaptations that have been made.
I think, personally, the only thing I would say is there is... It's a weird, because of the format as it is, they at 45 minutes in length, so they basically have...
Which, side note, was weird, because I was expecting with it being Tokusatsu Go Go Go, it was going to be 22-minute episodes.
You're not used to J-drama.
Yeah, so that surprised me, that they were longer episodes.
But that's, again, it's that thing where, because of the length it is, the sheer volume of content that they have put into the episode, if you aren't used to J-drama... can be intimidating.
Yes, I think it's something that's very common to J-drama. And again, I think this is actually something that Japanese dramas and a lot of English like miniseries have in common. And I think this is why American audiences don't always react well to British written like miniseries. I think it's just one of those things where it's like, you just go in being like, we are on full tilt every second of every episode of this 6-episode series. Fucking put your goggles on. We're fucking going for it. Sorry, I keep knocking the microphone.
I don't think that's as uncommon or at least unaccepted as it was before, because Game of Thrones has done a huge amount to push that idea.
I do think that things...
Game of Thrones is the most successful television show in the world right now, and it follows exactly that format.
I do think that there is a situation where we're moving more towards that globally. But I'm thinking more in the context of, I think to a certain extent people expect it from Game of Thrones because it has an epic, like I'm making air quotes, epic setup.
But I think the target demographic of this show are the same people that are already used to the Game of Thrones style 45 minutes in your face in one go sort of situation.
Not in Japan.
I would
argue, no, literally, yeah. As somebody who watches a lot of J-drama, the target demographic is like slightly introverted 20-something Japanese women who aren't necessarily that nerdy, but who feel a bit awkward.
This is also doing gangbusters with the Toku crowd.
So, oh, I can absolutely imagine. Like, I can absolutely imagine. But I do want to say, like, it's not necessarily...
This is like event television right now for the Toku crowd.
None of that stuff is necessarily what would have been thought of by investors.
I'm not sure that that's entirely off, because we are in, again, I don't want to spend but a
also,
lot of time...
But also, the Toku crowd is not necessarily the same as the Game of Thrones international investors.
Right
crowd.
Now, like, I'm not going to go into a big like Tokusatsu like history lesson or like catching up on the current situation, but things are really weird in Toku right now in Japan, and this fell at a very specific time. Right now, we're in the middle of... We just ended Strongest Battle. Super Sentai might get cancelled. There's a whole... The amount of people working on this show from the Toku community that work on all these shows, this is a concerted effort to like raise that like sort of interest in the branding.
See, I'm not thinking
there's
of the people...
There's a lot of changes right now.
I'm not thinking of the people who worked on the show. I'm thinking of the investors' goals. That's probably something where the investors are like, how did this happen? And everybody who works on the show is like, because we fucking made it happen, shut up. But it's one of those situations.
If this had happened any other year, I would completely agree with you. But right now, it feels completely off from
you
that.
You assume that investors are connected to pop culture. They're really not.
No, the investors are connected to money, which is something that the Tokusatsu brands aren't making right now. Things are bad. But you throw something like this, it was already a very popular manga at TV
right now, and
advertise those same people.
They won't have been thinking of money in terms of the Toku stuff. They will have been thinking of money in terms of the specific kind of like shoujo genre that it falls into.
I feel like you're underestimating the ties between the two as they stand
currently. I feel like
currently.
You're overestimating the amount to which the average investor in Japan gives a shit about pop culture. The thing is, a lot of like investors in stuff like this are not very good at judging media trends, which is why stuff takes people by surprise. Like a lot of the time they're often working like 2 years behind. And so it's a situation where it's like, this is a particular style of show that feels like somebody watched Princess Jellyfish and 2 years later thought, I hope we can do this. And because the people involved in the show knew what the fuck they were doing more than the investors, it managed to make it because they managed to be like, hey, we're in a weird place with Toku stuff right now. I bet we can get Toku fans to watch this show. It feels like a combination of those two factors. I feel like this would make more sense if you knew what Princess Jellyfish was.
I also feel like this would make more sense if you knew more about Toku.
Oh, in terms of the interconnectedness of the fandom, yeah.
Not just the fandom, but the people behind actual... Like, Toku is big in Japan in terms of the people that run it and operate it.
The investors aren't the same people, and usually, though, for Japanese media companies, because they're normally people who aren't involved in any stage of the production. They're capital venturers.
This is the same people that invest...
I'm talking about... To be clear, I'm talking about capital venturers.
Yeah, this is the same sort of people that invest money into Disney to do Marvel stuff.
I mean, that's definitely different.
I mean, that entire, like, capsule of stuff that is Marvel stuff, you look at that and you go, that's making gangbusters, that's making money, venture capitalists are going to, like, want part of that.
But the thing is,
Toku stuff, there's a lot of stuff going on where it was at a Marvel point, where it's having its own bubble burst that Marvel will eventually get in the future. We all see it happening. Your Disney rank can come immediately after the bubble bursts.
Listen.
But this is all reactionary from what I've seen.
And that's why you come to this podcast, because me and Briggy are capable of arguing about economics for far too long, bearing in mind... And I am fully implicating myself in this. Neither of us are economists, however the fuck you pronounce that word.
At least I can say it.
Economist or economist?
Economist.
Yeah, economist.
Thank you. I studied linguistics at university. I should know that.
But the funniest thing about the whole conversation you both just had...
Just edit it all out and put the bit in where I'm just like, me and Briggy should not be allowed to talk about this for 20 minutes.
There'll be editing, which I'm going to edit this. But... The point is you're both coming at this, the irony is you're both coming at this conversation about what the value is in terms of the fandom for the value of the fandom in terms of investors for a slice of life or a talk show. That's this show.
Yeah.
That is literally the clash between what the individuals who are fans of things versus the actual day-to-day slice of life mundanity of rest of the office
who
aren't fans.
They literally just played us, didn't they?
Yeah. It's
like a damn fiddle.
It's like...
Okay, shut up. Shut up, Kaz.
But it's the combination of those two worlds colliding. It's like neither of them understand each other's viewpoint entirely. They might be aware.
This is postmodernism. This is what it is.
But it's funny that we... As fans of the idea of these sort of shows, because as Briggy said, this you could take the toku out of it and put in any sort of geek culture. And there's loads of shows.
Loads of them.
Where they do just go, it's like, I'm a really big fan into ice skating or...
Yeah, that's Yuri on Ice.
Yeah, any number of these shows. But the point is the reason, like any of those shows you might enjoy to watch to a degree, but this lands so much more for you because you then get the other side of things being the toku side.
It has been difficult for me to try and like have a crowbar separation there between the toku and everything else in there to make me wonder, is this truly a really funny, well-written show, or is it just playing well to me?
Hmm.
And I've thought about that, and I still think...
I think it is.
To some degree, that it's genuinely a funny, well-written show. I don't think too much, especially when you start getting further into the episodes and the tokusatsu itself starts to take a backseat to the story. I don't think it's entirely the toku that's selling me. Because I've watched this for 100% different reason to why I'm watching Kamen Rider.
Exactly.
But because some of those jokes are relatable, it made it much easier to jump into in the kickoff to it. But it genuinely is a funny... funny show.
I will say...
It's a great, wholesome and hilarious comedy. It works.
I will say that as somebody with fairly limited, like, not non-zero, trust me, I know Briggy, we have watched some toku together. But as somebody with comparatively limited, like, certainly not nerdy interest in toku stuff, like, I really enjoyed, like, I just really... The first episode was just so fun and so... like, wholesome. Like, I literally turned to you, Briggy, at one point and was like, this is the most wholesome show, but not, like, in a condescending, patronising way, just in the sense that it's fun. Like, it's just an enjoyable show. And I hope that Paul just cuts out the parts where we talk excessively about the economics behind
the
show.
I'm sure he will.
Please do. It's just me being a disgusting Marxist. But just genuinely, just on its own merits, the show is fun, it's funny, and it's very sincere in a way that I think a lot of people will enjoy.
Briggy, would you recommend the show?
I would wholeheartedly recommend the show. I'm going to go on podcast record as stating this is my contender and almost probably winner of my show of 2019.
Briggy has told me that if he says anything to the contrary in the next, 9 months, then I'm allowed to hit him.
I'd never said You're allowed to hit me. I said you had to remind me that Tokusatsu Gurga exists.
That's how I'm going to remind you.
So this is a strong contender. It's going to have to be something real big and real impressive to knock this from top spot. Bear in mind, I've not watched the last episode. That's something we have to do post-podcast. But unless this is a garbage finale, which I don't think it's going to be, yeah, it sits up there. I'd highly recommend this for anyone that has any level of experience being a nerd or a geek. I think this plays well to most people, and I think it plays especially well to Toka fans. But overall, I think if you've got those experiences, this works. It will translate. Maybe you'll miss one or two jokes, not even massive ones, and those that you may not get initially are explained to you as they expect you to not be massively up on Toku to get this story. A lot of it is told to you with, you know, these flashcard type interlaced cuts of, oh no, this is an explanation of what that joke is, this is an explanation of that, and you start to pick up on it, oh, this is that thing. You deal with the shoujo anime, like, otaku at one point, you deal with idol group otakus at some point, and I'm not always 100% up with those things, but they explain them in a way, and the jokes play in a way that I still found them just as funny as the Toku stuff that I actually did get. So overall, I think this is a damn good comedy. I think it's a fantastically wholesome story, and I really hope it gets a season 2. Like, just as a fan of this kind of show. Not just Toku, but just good, well-made, funny shows. And yeah, I'm surprised that it's this early in the year and it's a Japanese drama that's completely out of my wheelhouse. It's something that I thought was the best show I've seen so far.
That's always the best stuff, though. The stuff that surprises you.
If that's not an insane recommendation to watch 7 episodes of a television show, then, like, come on, guys. There are people at work right now that are losing sleep because they're re-watching Game of Thrones before the new season starts. Like,
which is not worth it.
Set aside some time. Watch some Tokusatsu Gagaga. I mean, you can stream it. It's not available officially anywhere yet, unfortunately. If there's a way for me to give these people money to officially support it, I will happily do so.
It does sound like the kind of thing that Netflix would be interested in acquiring.
If they do it, I'll watch it again.
Because, again, Netflix is doing, like, Toku stuff.
Netflix original.
Yeah.
They just slick the logo on. It's literally just a licensing fee.
I was disappointed that it wasn't on Crunchyroll. I thought this would be a strong contender for the dramas that Crunchyroll has. It doesn't have that many, and it's not actually a Toku show, and it doesn't carry the same legal problems that the other Toku shows do because of their weird distribution platform and the way that Power Rangers plays in America. And so there's legal things all over the place for why those couldn't maybe go straight to Crunchyroll, but this is separate from that, and I thought with all the hype that it was getting online, both in the East and West, that this would have been on Crunchyroll, but unfortunately they haven't picked it up yet.
Probably issues with regard to the production studio licensing.
Possibly.
That's usually what it is with Crunchyroll.
But if you can find a way to watch it online, and it is out there, I mean, you're adults, you're smart enough to figure this out for yourself, go watch it, but then I would implore you, if it does become officially available and you can support the official release, please do so, because this is so worth the time and the money. This is one of those things that I would not be upset to throw money at, like,
listen,
to watch again.
If they give you an opportunity to throw money at something that you love, just do it. Even if you've watched it before, just do it.
Like, and with all things I enjoy, if they create merchandise, I will buy some. I would love to have a Shishiryu keychain. I think that'd be brilliant. That's a great way to, like, send them to the show. Like, yeah, give me this tiny bit of merchandise.
Oh,
a plot point.
You get the red one, I'll get the blue one.
Yeah, they'd be awesome, but
and then everybody will ship us.
Until they make that available, yeah, just get a chance to watch it online, and if it is available officially, support it somewhere, but it's absolutely worth your time. Absolutely. I cannot recommend it highly enough. That is, I don't think you're going to get a recommendation out of me to this degree for quite a while.
Also, I mean, you can cut this, but also, like, I watched, like, one episode, and I was like, there's Fem Slash in this shit, I'm gonna watch the rest of it. And you literally turned to me and was just like, they're my OTP. There's these two women in it, and I'm literally like, they are going to date.
Trigger lady.
I'm literally like, this is a meet cute in a rom-com between these two ladies, and I love them, and I would die for them. And even Briggy agrees, so. And he's not even, like, a fucking massive lesbian or anything.
Yeah, cool.
Sorry, I just flashed to an Eddie Izzard joke. I was like, I mean,
that's always a good choice.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, on that note, as Top Gear says,
something with the name something with Tokusatsu in its name ends up being one of the best shows I've seen this year. Not surprised, although.
No.
This time, I think people might agree with me.
Yeah, I might. Hey, listen, I'm enjoying it very much. For the record, I watched one episode, and I'm immediately like, I'm going to watch the other 6 in the next week.
We'll just wait for Kamen Rider's year to end and the next one to start, and I can start watching it live, and then maybe that one will take it. It won't.
What are you talking about? You love the Kamen Riders.
I love my Kamen Riders, but I don't think any of them have ever been this good.
Give me the Bugman.
Even Amazon's wasn't this good. Yeah. Amazon's is pretty good.
I mean, Series 2, you said we should.
Yeah, but maybe Series 2 of Tokusatsu Gagaga won't be very good. We'll find out. Maybe we'll find out that the main character of season 2 was the bad guy the whole time, and suddenly it all makes sense.
Briggy is very bitter about Kamen Rider Amazons or whatever the fuck it's called. Anyway, on
that note...
The
movie
was
good. The movie made up for it.
On that note, we have to sign out, Briggy.
We do, and I'm hoping that there's enough content that Paul can cut around.
We're fine.
I meant listenable. Cool, give me a short episode.
Doctor Who all the way.
Doctor Who, me dying about Sonic, and I guess economics like 3 times. We just turned into the economics podcast.
We jump over Doctor Who, we get that transition of you playing the Tokusatsu Gagaga theme. It's about 30 seconds of me going, yeah, it's a good show, and we end the show.
It's just me being like, let me explain economic theory. Just cut all of that, I'm sorry. Anyway, Briggy.
Okay, I guess that's been an episode. We talked about all the things. Who knows what remains in the episode and what is on the cutting room floor. Paul will decide our fate. So, but that's been us for another week of the Geeks Codex podcast. I've been Matthew Briggs, as per usual, your host extraordinaire. I've been joined by the world's best editor, Paul Stevens.
Goodbye.
And the slightly tipsy, but yet still effervescent, James Cook.
You know you'll miss me.
That's been all from us this time, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.